BCFM 93.2. Broadcasting live from the Cascade Steps at the Bristol Harbour Festival. Saturday, 31st July. And Sunday, 1st August.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
Welcome back to Friday Drive Time with old Labour economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Now, the new Lord Chancellor and Justice Secretary Kenneth Clark says our prisons are full and that for first-time offenders, our prisons are maybe colleges of crime. Therefore, we should not lock up offenders if their sentence is under a year. Quite a turnaround in Conservative policy. But the recent furore in the North West when Raoul Moat went on the rampage, killing one and seriously injuring another policeman as well as his former partner, raises questions about this strategy. So, are we locking the right people up? Should we be making better use of community sentences? And to what extent is the push to privatise prisons affecting the standards in the prison service provides? Well, to answer these and other questions, I'm joined this evening by Andrew Nielsen, who's the Deputy Director of the Howard League for Penal Reform. Hello, Andrew. Welcome to Drive Time. Now, first of all, what is the Howard League and how did it start?
The Howard League is an independent charity, independent from government. A lot of the charities in the criminal justice sector do government contracts, but the Howard League doesn't take government money, and that's very important to us because we're a campaigning group, and we feel that our freedom to speak is very important. We've been doing it for over 140 years. The Howard League has been involved in some of the major developments in criminal justice over the last 100 years, from the foundation of the probation service, the founding of victim support, the abolition of capital punishment, and generally reform around criminal justice, law and order, and what happens in prisons.
So was there any sort of one specific thing that got the Howard League started in the first place?
I think obviously the condition of prisons, particularly in the 19th century, and the use of prison, where you saw things like debtors' prisons, prison ships, that Victorian kind of Dickensian era, was probably the main driving focus of a lot of the Howard League's early work. Most recently, though, our major concern has been around rising numbers in the prison population. It's more or less doubled since the early 90s, and that the effect on ever more women, children and men being placed in prison.
So why has the prison population gone up so much, you were saying, since the early 90s? That's incredible for it to have doubled in such a short space of time.
Yes, well, Ken Clark, the Justice Secretary, who was Home Secretary in the very late 80s, early 90s, remarked that it was quite, if someone had gone up to him and said the prison population will have doubled by 2010, he would have laughed at them. Why did it happen? Well, Michael Hurd became Home Secretary under the John Major government and famously declared prison works and ushered in a kind of new era of very harsh policies in terms of sentencing. Sentences have increasingly got longer, more crimes have been created by the government, so more people commit crimes, therefore end up in prison. That was very much taken up with real relish by the new Labour government. Tony Blair had a philosophy of what he called triangulation, being more right-wing than the right. And on Law and Order, that was a classic area where New Labour pushed even further than the major government had on these issues. And many bills of criminal justice legislation were created. Allegedly, around 3,000 new offences were created since 1997, around half of which can attract a prison sentence. And all sorts of other developments in sentencing have really pushed numbers up.
Can you get a bit more specific and tell me about some of these new types of crime, which now people are actually serving sentences for, which maybe they wouldn't have been before?
Well, the most famous example, and this is very timely to talk about, would be antisocial behaviour. Antisocial behaviour is not a crime. It isn't dealt with by the criminal justice system, or at least it wasn't traditionally. If antisocial behaviour crept into actual crimes like assault, robbery, then it would be dealt with by criminal justice. But the general idea of low-level nuisance behaviour being dealt with by the criminal justice system, that didn't used to be the case. It used to be local authorities and the kind of civil system that dealt with that. Then New Labour introduced ASBOs, antisocial behaviour orders, and they imposed lots of conditions on people. And so what you then found was that people started to breach their ASBOs. When they breached their ASBOs, they often ended up in prison, but not ending up in prison for what was originally a crime that would have got you a prison sentence. And we saw only last week Theresa May, the Home Secretary, saying that perhaps the days of the ASBO have come to an end because they haven't really had the impact that they were meant to have. And what they have done is see a lot of people in prison who wouldn't have been in prison 10, 15 years ago.
So you say you don't take Home Office money or you don't take money for your activities because that keeps you independent. Do you think then that there are some prison campaigning groups that are somehow compromised by taking that government money?
I'd be wary of criticising other charities in that sense.
What I'm trying to get at is what might be the temptation there? What kind of thing might happen if you were to take government money?
Well, what's true is if you deliver services to people in the prison system or in the community on community sentences and you're a charity, then you're obviously doing that on a government contract. Either local government or central government is contracting you to do that. Now, it stands to reason that that means that you have to be careful about what you say publicly because you don't want to annoy the people that are commissioning you. And that's very understandable. And that's all I would say is that I think that service providers in the charity world have to be that little bit more careful. It's important to us that we don't have that problem. Although what's true, I would say, about service providers in their favour is that because they deliver services, they obviously understand the issues on the ground in a way that organisations like the Howard League don't always. And one of the things we've done to develop that is we now have a legal service that represents young people in prison. Some might say that it takes government money because it's funded partly by legal aid, but we see that as a sufficient remove from direct contracts from a department or a local authority. And certainly it hasn't affected our ability to speak out when we feel we need to.
So going back to first principles, as you are quite an old organisation, what do you think the purpose of prison should be?
Well, it's a very good question. Historically, there have been various purposes to prison applied. One would be deterrence. So deterrence is both general and specific. What specific deterrence is, you commit a crime, you go to prison. And because you know you'll go to prison, you commit that crime, because you've gone to prison, when you come out, you won't do it again. Now, that's been pretty exploded as a myth by the reoffending rates, which are so high. But the more general concept of deterrence is that as a society, you or I, the only thing stopping us from throwing a brick through the local Tesco's and stealing the till is the fact that we know that we might go to prison. There are other reasons as well, other purposes for imprisonment. Another one that people talk about is public protection. That's something that Howard League would certainly say is a valuable purpose of prison for those very dangerous and serious offenders. There, you know, you're using prison to protect people from someone who, you know, has murdered and may murder again, or has raped and may rape again. And that public protection element is very important. There's also the idea that prison can rehabilitate. You might be surprised to hear that the Howard League is a bit suspicious about that. You might expect us to say prison is all about rehabilitation. We're not convinced actually prisons are very good or ever will be very good at rehabilitation because they're so divorced from the community where crimes occur and the pressures that people feel that may lead them to crime. So you do get guys who go into prison pretty trouble-free and maybe do lots of programs and seem to be doing well, but as soon as they get out of prison, you know, they're back in the pub with their old mates and they're offering them some drugs and they can't say no. And so really rehabilitation works best in the community. The final use of purpose for prison, which the Howard League does think is absolutely real, is it's a punishment. If you are taking someone's liberty away from them, then you are punishing them. And sometimes that's lost in the arguments. I think one of the reasons why prison numbers have increased so much is because actually this idea that prison can rehabilitate, in other words, sometimes in a very well-meaning way, politicians have thought, oh, well, if we put these people in prison, they'll come out better people, have used it. I would be much more honest. Prison is a punishment. If you want to punish people, if society wants to punish people, fair enough. But don't add on these kind of promises that it will make people better, because by and large it doesn't. There are exceptions, but certainly by and large prison makes people worse.
How many of the people who are currently in jail around the UK do you think really should be in there, in the Howard League's view? Are there many people who should be either in doing community sentences or are improperly being incarcerated?
That's a very good question. It's difficult to say because times have changed. But really, it does seem odd that we don't have prison levels roughly the same that we had in the early 1990s. Our population as a country hasn't rocketed that much overall. And so why really have we seen that numbers? We would suggest that most of the rise has been pretty unnecessary.
Do you think it's possible maybe that there's been just a change in human nature over that time and that people have becoming more criminal?
No, I don't believe that. I don't believe we're more criminal than we were. In fact, the statistics show that's not the case. Recorded crime has dropped by something like 40%. Why has crime dropped? Because people might say it's because prison numbers have risen. Well, we know that crime has largely actually the crime that's really dropped, that's contributed to this massive drop in crime, recorded crime, is burglary and car theft. Both things which have been actually more influenced by the fact we up until very recently had a good economic climate from the early 90s to till about a couple of years ago. And also improvements in home security and car security, and generally a decrease in the price of secondhand goods. I mean, if you burgle someone's house and steal their television, back in the 80s that was lucrative. It's not lucrative anymore. So there are always other reasons than criminal justice system reasons why crime falls. But you know, you only need to look at footage from the late 1970s of in the era of punk and to see that we were perhaps a considerably less safe society then.
Now, Anne Owers, I think that's how you pronounce it. Is that right? Anne Owers?
That's right, yes.
She was the chief inspector of prisons up until very recently. And a couple of weeks ago, she gave a speech where she was saying, well, two main things, which I pulled out from the speech, which was one is a gang culture, actually in prisons and out of prisons. What does she really mean by that, the gang culture?
Well, we have a gang culture problem in the community. And that breaks out into offending from time to time. And gang members find themselves in prison. So the most kind of, I suppose, notorious example of this would be that there was a rash of knife crime a couple of years ago and lots of teenagers in gangs being killed. That's one example of a gang. But also generally, so you get gangs from the community finding themselves in prison or members of those gangs in prison. The other issue that's a problem is that gangs form naturally in prison because people, this is the college of crime argument that Ken Clark was using. You know, if you put a lot of people, if you put some bad people and some people who have got into trouble but are maybe not as bad as the bad people, but they're all in this one place where they're lumped together and called prisoners, they do tend to form relationships. People learn off each other. This is the fear that, when you send particularly young people to prison, why do 75% of them reoffend? Well, they're mixing, with other young people who've got problems or who are really actually quite troubled. And that actually isn't a healthy thing for them, and indeed it causes problems. The gang culture is particularly worrying in the high security estate, because there we have a lot of black minority ethnic prisoners from inner cities being shipped out into high secure prisons, which are in rural areas. The staff are drawn from that area, and so are largely white. Don't have the same kind of contact with BME prisoners that they would in the inner cities. And that gap between staff and prisoners is causing real tensions and real gang problems, which are increasingly difficult for staff to manage.
The other thing that Anne mentioned was the UK's first private prison, which, another report has also condemned. What's the Howard League's position on private prisons?
Well, we have a principled position, which is we don't believe in private prisons. I mean, we think it is wrong to privatise punishment, that punishment should not be done for profit, that if it is the responsibility of the state to try, sentence and arrest an individual, it should also be the responsibility of the state to punish that individual.
But the argument is, of course, that often organisations, private organisations, can actually run institutions like prisons, for example, more efficiently because of their profit motive.
That is the argument, yes. There's no evidence to back that up. The National Audit Office did a report which said that it was neither more effective or less effective. They couldn't really decide. In America, I mean, to give you a more practical concern, the experience we've had the experience the Americans have had with private prisons. I mean, people may be aware that America jails, I mean, we jail a lot of people, but America jails a huge amount of people. One in every 100 Americans behind bars at this point in time. They are off the scale in terms of the amount of people they put in prison. And one of the drivers behind that, just one, is the use of private prisons, because it is in the very nature of a company with a duty to shareholders to expand, to make money. And the only way you can expand and make money in a prison system is by running more prisons. And there have been some very high-profile examples of how that can go badly wrong. I'll give you two. One was a case, I can't remember which state it was now, on the East Coast, where famously a judge was being given bungs by the private company running the jail in order to jail more children, and children were getting jailed for all sorts of silly things like graffitiing a caricature of a teacher in school, terrible things like that. And then in California, famously, California is the worst state for prison numbers. It spends more on prison than higher education. And the situation in California is that Arnold Schwarzenegger came to power on a ticket of prison reform, of reducing the numbers. He was defeated by an unholy alliance of lobbyists from the private companies running the prisons and the prison officer unions in the prisons. Why were the prison officer unions in alliance? Because they owned the shares in the companies. It can be very, very tricky allowing the private sector and the market into the prison system.
Now, earlier this month, there was, as I was saying, Anne Hours, who's the outgoing prison inspector, was talking about somewhere called HMP Wolds, which is Britain's first ever private prison, where a report into that was saying that prisoners at HMP Wolds were found to be high on drugs while prison officers were low in confidence. She said in her, this was actually her report, and this has been seized on by penal reform groups, I suppose, such as yourselves, criticising the over-reliance on private companies to run new prisons. So where's this at now? Are we going to see a rollout of more new prisons? Are they just ignoring these signs, danger signs?
The new government has committed to try to reduce the prison population, but they do still want to build new prisons because they want to close some of the very old prisons that are in this country. So the prisons minister announced last week the closure of Lancaster Castle, which has been a prison since the 12th century. So they want to modernise the estate, and the way that they intend to do that is by, yes, closing prisons, but also building some new ones, and that will be likely by private companies. In fact, it will be by private companies. There's nothing likely about it. It's difficult, you know, because to some degree, if you go to some private prisons, they do look quite good compared to some of the Brixton, which is an old Victorian jail, or many of the public prison service prisons. But you do have to remind yourself that, in fact, no public prison has been built for many, many years now in this country. So all the new shiny ones are private. So of course they look better. The other thing to bear in mind with the Wolds, which Anne Orr has mentioned, was that when it opened with a great fanfare of publicity, and it was a much better prison than it is now. Because another thing that is natural, kind of natural behaviour with private companies when they run prisons, is they bid for very long contracts. They front load the contract, so to speak. So to get the contract, to win the bid, they do all sorts of singing and dancing, whistles and bells, great things at the beginning. They get the contract, that happens for a while, but then there is a real pattern of private prisons. Then 5 or 6 years down the line, a lot of that gets dropped, and all of a sudden the prison is increasingly run to cut costs and to squeeze as much profit out as possible, and the longer the private prison runs, the worse it gets.
Now, Martin Summers is still with us from the first hour, Oxford economist. Martin, what are your thoughts about, because I know you've got some quite strong views about something we were talking about just then, which is drugs in prisons, and also the whole sort of gang and drug culture, and how that, because I mean, you know, as we're in a recession, I would imagine that if people can't get work, they can't get jobs, they're being thrown off of benefits, that this is actually going to help the gang culture.
Well, of course it is. I mean, there's the wider social problems that which bound up with economic crisis.
People will go into that sort of underground economy rather than get a proper job.
Well, because they haven't actually got any other option in a lot of cases. Now, the drugs industry as a whole is a major driver of imprisonment and of crime. And we're not just thinking of people using drugs, we're thinking of people settling scores, for example. Like it increasingly looks like the young lad that was killed on Stapleton Road a few weeks ago was probably something to do with the settling of scores in the drugs industry. And of course, if you're involved in the drugs industry, it is an industry, it's run like everything else, you can't phone the police and say, this guy hasn't paid me. You have to go and sort it out yourself, you know, and have to make people scared of you and so on. So there's a whole problem about this, which the illegal drugs market creates a whole section of society involved in activities from the smallest fry to the biggest fish, which is outside the purview of the general economy and therefore generates crime at every stage of the process. And of course, there's an immense amount of hypocrisy about this, not just that we have alcohol and tobacco legal, but all these other things are illegal, but we've got absolutely cast iron evidence that the Western intelligence services have been involved in major drugs dealing for years. And I've got a couple of quotes here just to back this up. So the Independent confirmed in January of this year that evidence points to aircraft familiarly known as torture taxis used by the CIA to move captives seized in its kidnapping or extraordinary renditions operation through Gatwick and other airports in the EU being simultaneously used for drug distribution in the Western Hemisphere. Hugh O'Shaughnessy, confirming earlier reporting by Bill Conroy and Daniel Hopsicker, said that a Gulfstream II jet aircraft identified by the British government and the European Parliament as being involved in this traffic crashed in Mexico in September 2008 while en route from Colombia to US with a load of more than 3 tons of cocaine. Shaughnessy states that the US intelligence assets continue the drug dealing they indulged in during the Iran-Contra affair of the Reagan years. I've got a further quote here. This is a quote from the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime. So part of the fallout from capitalism's economic meltdown has been that drugs money worth billions of dollars kept the financial system afloat at the height of the global crisis, the Observer disclosed late last year. Antonio Maria Costa, UNODC's director, told the British newspaper he saw evidence that proceeds from the illicit drug trade were the only liquid investment capital available to some banks on the brink of collapse last year, and the majority of the $352 billion of drugs profits was absorbed into the economic system as a result. Now, we've got a situation where our own intelligence services are involved in major drugs dealing, as they were in Afghanistan and Colombia, and still are, because we've now got CIA renditions planes being caught by Mexican police with lots of cocaine on them. Meanwhile, we're locking up petty offenders who are using and dealing those drugs locally, and of course causing a problem, because illegal drugs do cause a problem, and a lot of the problems is to do with the illegality of the market which they're operating. Senior Latin American politicians have recently issued a report saying we've got to change our attitude towards drugs, otherwise we are going to lose control of the streets of our cities. Now, I'm not saying that this is a panacea, because it isn't. Not all crime is caused by drugs. But I would suggest that a big source of the increase in prisoners that we've seen in the last 10 years is due to the increasing illegal drugs market, which carries on growing. Now, we've got to face up to this. The illegal drugs, there's an NGO called Transform based here in Easton, which is campaigning for the legalisation of drugs. Now, I'm all in favour of that, but I want to take the argument a stage further. We've got comprehensive evidence that senior people at the top in the US and presumably in Britain are in fact major drug dealers. Now, if we're serious about the rule of law, Colonel Oliver North, who was actually named as a drug dealer in the investigations into Iran-Contra in the 80s, he should have been put in prison in the US, or possibly, because of some of the things he was doing under existing US law, he should have been executed. Now, what we've got is prison for poor people and profits to be made from that, and wealthy criminals not only walking free but walking away with public sector pensions.
Now, I don't know if you've got any particular reaction to that, Andrew.
Yeah, the Howard League supports Transforms. I mean, we don't have a line on legalisation of drugs, but we, as an official line as an organisation, we do support a call that Transform has made about an evidence-based policy on drugs. Because actually, if you had an evidence-based policy on drugs, then you'd be moving pretty much towards some form of legalisation or controlled legalisation. There is no doubt that drugs and the drugs trade is a major driver behind the rising prison population, behind crime on estates throughout, over the country. There is no doubt that you know, the law has struggled to control it, that we're losing the war on drugs, and we have been losing it for a very long time. And indeed, again, I mentioned America and its extraordinary prison population. Well, that's why they have an extraordinary prison, large prison population. 1 in 100 Americans, and I think 1 in 10 of every black men in America are behind bars, and drugs is really the big reason. I think that we are probably moving towards an opportunity to look at these issues differently as a global society. It may take a little bit of time yet, but I think it's increasingly obvious to anyone who thinks about it that the policy that successive international governments have taken on this issue has completely failed.
Okay, now we're going to be talking in a moment about prison labour and about ASBOs. But before that, for A, B and C class drugs, for the softest are C, the classification of drugs in here in Britain is doubtful as to whether it exactly reflects how addictive they are, the damage they do to people who take them, or the crimes addicts commit here. Anyway, Life MC, who's a rapper from 2003, has got a song, with a song now about crack.
Life, you understand, it's a hard life. Yo, yo. Check it, check. Crack life, who wanna live it? Why you wanna smoke a substance that will crush your soul and your spirit? It don't take no rocket science or no form of quantum physics to work out from your pipe that shit, your life be finished. Tell me, crack life, who wanna live it? Why you wanna smoke a substance that will crush your soul and your spirit? It don't take no rocket science or no form of quantum physics to work out from your pipe that shit, your life be finished. Imagine the scene, a crack queen in the age of 16 gave birth to a crack baby, the father's a crack fiend, living in a crack house where everyone's high but there's no hygiene, and the baby's tears of hunger turn to painful hyper dreams. Even when the baby's fed, he's propped up in a pissy bed, covered in nappy sores and blisters, cradle crap still in his head. His baby's life is dread, born a crackhead but still a survivor, fed sour milk from a bottle that's never seen a sterilizer. Mommy cleans the baby's dummy with a crack mouth saliva. Most time her kid's not with her, but the pipe's always beside her. She's still a baby herself and shows no form of maturity. Cashes a book the same day she spends all the social security. For the rest of the week she has to sleep, it meant to feed her habit. Most time it's unprotected sex when she performs a sexual flex. Baby father said he hates the kicker that's always crying, not realizing the drip is showing and his kid's slowly dying. Crack life, who wanna live it? Why you wanna smoke a substance that will crush your soul and your spirit? It don't take no rocket science or no form of quantum physics to work out from your pipe that shit, your life be finished. Tell me, crack life, who wanna live it? Why you wanna smoke a substance that will crush your soul and your spirit? It don't take no rocket science or no form of quantum physics to work out from your pipe that shit, your life be finished. No one to maintain the yard, no one buys electric cars. The cupboards are bare in the kitchen where food's never prepared. Carpets and chairs are threadbare, bathroom compares to a toxic waste site. Curtains are permanently closed in a household that sees no daylight. Like the junkie service station with drugs are taking a soul. Drug addicts catching the corners high as kites or alcohol. Couching on the couch, dribbling like the parents' poor sibling who cry 24-7, never seen smiling or giggling. Where's the social services when they're needed? His kidney's feeding, he's hungry to the state, his stomach lining started bleeding. Babies inhale so much crack smoke, he's got asthmatic breathing. Even when this child is sleeping, it's not good things that he's dreaming. Today's his lucky day, his mother comes upstairs to feed him. She sees him through black eyes caused by another customer beating. But this baby's dying to death, it seems to be painful and slow. Worries embedded in the back of bones, dressed in a dirty baby robe. Tell me, crack life, who wanna live it? Why you wanna smoke a substance that will crush your soul and your spirit? It don't take no rocket science or no form of quantum physics to work out from your pipe that shit, your life be finished. Tell me, crack life, who wanna live it? Why you wanna smoke a substance that will crush your soul and your spirit? It don't take no rocket science or no form of quantum physics to work out from your pipe that shit, your life be finished. It's such a shame, a life of torment and pain, and the life that was overshadowed by that white crack cocaine. And of course there weren't no chance of the neighbors reporting the dangers. They were also drug takers, hypnotized by the crack vapors. That's why the fatal day came when this innocent baby soldier died of malnutrition with a tiny stomach full of ulcers. The dirty grimy room stinking of urine and feces odors to cause the death neglect from two parents who were never sober. And these are sufferings over cause his life was sorely doomed. And I pray his mother never decides again to use her womb. When the parents found the child that died both in a runaway, but they was caught and sent away to Parkhurst and Holloway. So tell me, crack life, who wanna live it? Why you wanna smoke a substance that will crush your soul and your spirit? It don't take no rocket science or no form of quantum physics to work out from your pipe that shit, your life be finished. Brother, crack life, who wanna live it? Why you wanna smoke a substance that will crush your soul and your spirit? It don't take no rocket science or no form of quantum physics to work out from your pipe that shit, your life be finished.
life. Who wanna live it? Why you wanna smoke a substance that will crush your soul and your spirit? It don't take no rocket science or the form of quantum physics to work up from your pipe. That shit, your life is finished.
From 2003, that's Life MC with Crack. And I'm joined in the studio now by Marina Morris, who has a report, as we were just discussing just now, about ASBOs that mean that there's many more people in jail now than they would have been otherwise. Now, Marina, what have you found out about ASBOs?
Hello. The Home Secretary, Theresa May, has announced an intention to abandon the ASBO. ASBOs were introduced in April 1999 and can be issued to anyone aged 10 or older committing antisocial acts. Official statistics show breaches of the orders had risen about 50%, and they are used less than ever. The Home Secretary said it was now time to move beyond the ASBO with simpler sanctions that were rehabilitation and restorative rather than criminalization and coercive. Instead, she is to launch a review of the powers available to the police to provide them these tools that are quick, practical and easier to use. The latest ASBO statistic published yesterday show that about 2,000 ASBO were issued in 2008, the lowest level since a peak of about 4,100 were issued in 2005. In all, 70,000 ASBOs have been issued since their introduction in April 1999. More than half of the people who breach the ASBO are jailed. According to a review conducted in 2002, 84% of the ASBOs issued until September 2001 were men, and 74% were aged 21 or less. But have ASBO been a success? According to the Home Office Statistical Bulletin Crime in England and Wales 2009-10, the proportion of people with a high level of perceived antisocial behavior has decreased from 17% to 14% compared with the equivalent 2008-9 statistic. This measure was introduced in 2001-2, the indicator was around 21%. Is this a symptom of changing times or partial success? The Shadow Home Secretary Alan Johnson said Ms. May was showing a lack of understanding about the powers already available to the police. He added, an antisocial behavior order is one of a series of different powers available to the police and is used when other punitive measures have failed. But what is the reason for this issue? Why the epidemic in antisocial behavior? Poor values, bad authority figures, love or lack of respect and misunderstanding of what is right or wrong could cause people to do this. They lose self-control and take their aggression against the neighbors. Can people positively change their behavior? Of course they can. Everybody has the ability consciously to get control of their bad behavior by education, examples. But if the negative emotion, dark inner force, wins the battle, punishment may be only one option.
Thanks very much, Marina. Now, Andrew, I think many people listening will be thinking, well, hang on a minute, actually, you know, we're really fed up with antisocial behaviour. And despite what Marina's been saying there, that actually it's really irritating that one of the things that many people see as, you know, is actually positive over the last 10 years or so, that we're actually getting particularly disruptive youngsters off the streets, that you're not actually supporting that.
I think that antisocial behaviour is a very important issue, and it is an issue for people in communities up and down the country. It would be wrong to ignore it. I mean, one of the reasons why the Labour government introduced ASBOs, and I was once upon a time a civil servant, and I worked for a number of ministers around the time that ASBOs were being implemented. And the reason that Labour ministers and MPs supported this was because they went to their constituencies on a Friday. And it was a long queue of people complaining about antisocial behaviour and low-level nuisance behaviour. So, they represented the constituencies where it was a real issue. And that's understandable. It is an issue. we would argue there are better ways of tackling antisocial behaviour than trying to manage it with orders that ban people from doing things.
Yes, but how?
Well, for example, let me give you an example of an American. We talked about America, keep going back to that, but the American example of very high prison numbers in America, and some states are actually more or less bankrupt because of the amount of people they now put in prison. And what they have there is they've come up with something that they call justice reinvestment, which has had broad political support from both Republicans and Democrats. What justice reinvestment does is it maps crime and potentially antisocial behaviour, and it looks at the areas where it's mostly a problem. And what they found when they did this was they found what they call million-dollar blocks. What is a million-dollar block? Well, it's a block where $1 million a year was being spent on incarcerating its inhabitants. And the question behind justice reinvestment is, okay, well, what if we spent some of that $1 million actually on the block? I think if you talk about antisocial behaviour, you'll look at blocks or estates in the UK, which had similar problems to the million-dollar blocks in the States, whether it's needles in the stairwells, nowhere for kids to play publicly, no safe public spaces, a lack of employment opportunities, training opportunities, problems perhaps with mental health in the community that aren't really being treated. There are all sorts of social problems in areas where antisocial behaviour is actually merely a symptom of those problems. And the best way to tackle the behaviour is to tackle the actual problems behind it, which help create the kind of community where things are not as strong as they might be, and this kind of behaviour leaks out and becomes a major problem for everyone.
Now, what prisoners are doing, particularly if they're inside for years rather than months, is crucial when considering whether or not a reformed character will come out at the end of the day. So the Home Office and Prison Service must get the balance right somewhere between the academic study and the sweatshop labour. Now, journalist Phil Chamberlain is joining me now, who helped set up a website, prisonlabour.org.uk. Hi, Phil, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hello there.
Now, why did you choose this topic to write on?
Well, as a journalist, I'm interested in information. I'm interested in information which isn't readily available to the public to inform public debate. Myself and a colleague, Richard Cookson, spent 3 years getting out of the prison service details on prison labour. That's something they wanted to not release, something they fought quite hard to keep secret, which is the links between private companies and prisons. And when companies or the government wants to keep something secret, I tend to get interested. Something you want to have a look into. I think if you're going to have a debate about rehabilitation, about prison service, then you need the facts and the information available to make a judgment as you see fit. And I was interested, along with Rich, in making facts and information available.
So you had some freedom of information requests. Well, what did you find out?
So we found that there are dozens and dozens of companies which have set up contracts with individual prisons for prisons to carry out all sorts of different kind of work. So you'll find names such as Virgin Atlantic. So next time you fly Virgin and you want to listen to the in-flight movie, then your headphones will probably have been packed by a prisoner. So similarly with Monarch Airlines, Travis Perkins do perhaps contracts, and Macmillan as well. You tend to find most of these contracts aren't for highly skilled work for various obvious reasons. They're going to be for low-level, rather mundane jobs. So if you go into a DIY store and all the kind of nuts and bolts that are kind of stored away in those little plastic packages, that's just the kind of work that is outsourced to prisoners.
Now, traditionally, I mean, I can certainly remember the whole thing of prisoners sewing mailbags. I mean, this is on some of these alien comedies and films from years ago. And that was, I suppose, was it actually different? Do you think there's a sort of a qualitative difference in doing things like that, which are for a public service rather than for a private profit?
I mean, I'm not an expert on terms about what kind of work benefits prisoners the best. I certainly recall when I spoke to Jonathan Aiken, who was the former Tory minister jailed for perjury. He said that on his first day when he was inside, he was sent into the garden of the prison, and he was asked to move a load of rocks from one side of the garden to the other, and then in the afternoon he moved them back again. And I think that was just kind of keeping him occupied in some way. There's an element of keeping prisoners occupied if you're banged up inside for 20 hours. hours a day, then frankly doing anything kind of different helps you perhaps doing, you know, stops going stir crazy for something. In terms of sewing mailbags, I mean, a lot of the work that we discover is being done is of a low level nature, but then look at the environment that prisoners are in, you know, the ability to be able to put in kind of equipment or training necessary requires a whole different kind of mindset, and you're looking at a very special and specialised area, so it's probably unreasonable to expect in some ways that you're going to get the same opportunities. Nonetheless, it still seems that it's a very low basic level, perhaps designed more to keep prisoners occupied and provide a cheap labour force for certain companies than perhaps any rehabilitation purposes.
So why do you think the prison service was so reluctant to hand this information out? I mean, did you get any insight into why they were being so secretive about
it? Yeah, I mean, in their refusal to us, they said that the likely consequences of the identification of companies holding contracts with prisons will include loss of business, layoffs of workers, becoming the subjects of campaigns against the use of prison labour, and adverse publicity. I guess that includes appearing on this radio station, all of which we would feel would prejudice commercial interests, as it happened in other cases. But it took 3 years and several tribunal hearings for us to overturn that. And the findings of the Information Commissioner who investigated this was that there was no evidence for any of these concerns about either commercial confidentiality being breached or campaigns against companies or indeed layoffs of workers. We've seen no evidence of any of these contracts of any decline in the total value number of contracts. It simply feels like embarrassment, to be honest. And the holding position, the first stage position, is we'd just rather not talk about it. Thanks very much.
So how much are our prisoners paid? Like, how much per hour?
Mm-mm. Well, it obviously kind of varies, but if you want to kind of if your listeners want to kind of guess the average weekly wage for a prisoner is less than £10 a week. You're probably getting, you know,
So how much work is that? What's that? I mean, if we just translate it into the minimum wage, which is what, £6,
well, they're not covered by the
hour.
Minimum wage, which is
no, they're not. But I mean, to compare it, how much are they actually getting per hour? If they're getting whatever it is, £10 a week, that's not a lot per hour, is it?
Well, it would depends on prison to prison. And this is the issue where you have companies set up contracts with individual prisons, not with the prison service as a whole. So it's up to the contract that's drawn up between the prison and the private company about how prisoners get paid. Suffice to say that it's a non-extremely extensive rate.
Well, it sounds like it could be as low as something like sort of 30 pence an hour or something like that. So can prisoners actually choose not to work if they want to? Are they actually forced to or not?
I don't know, actually. I mean, I think that there's an element of I mean, there have been some claims that prisoners do receive adverse effects if they refuse to carry out certain tasks. But I guess again that they may be something decided prison by prison in terms of their own rules about whether they can or cannot take up certain activities.
Well, Andrew Nielsen from the Howard League for Penal Reform, can I just bring you in again on that? What's your knowledge on that topic?
I believe that they can't be forced to work because that would be slave labour. Certainly if you do participate in work activities, then you're more likely, I suppose, to earn privileges in the prison system. As Phil says, it varies from prison to prison, but you know, the ability to have a TV in your cell, for example, you know, you have to have earned your privileges and also earn some money, because the prisoners pay for that, and of course the way to earn money in a prison is to do work. So there are incentives to do it, but they certainly can't compel people.
Now, I had a chat to an ex-prisoner, this is 3 or 4 years ago, who was talking about spending weeks and weeks, if not months, putting together indicator sticks for BMWs. It's little things like this. It's kind of assembly-type jobs that they're doing, which worried me, because I know the Quant family, who own BMWs, actually made their fortune in the Second World War, actually making batteries for the Nazi war effort, submarine batteries and things like that. Actually the money they made from this submarine battery company they then used to buy BMW. So it's a little bit concerning that that the slave labour that was going on in the Second World War is now being used by BMW in a way similarly in prisons to put together these indicator sticks, although of course it's not actually slave labour, as you were saying. It's rather concerning that companies are actually getting into this, and especially possibly, Andrew, with the privatisation of prisons, we might see an increase in this kind of thing.
Possibly. I mean, to be honest, I have no problem with private companies employing prisoners to do work, as long as they pay them a decent wage and they have some genuine employer-employee relationship. So, for example, you know, if Virgin Air want prisoners to package their headphones, fine, as long as they pay them a decent wage and perhaps have a foreman in the prison who prisoners can have some relationship with and maybe get a job at when they come out. And also it would be nice if they could give them a bit more highly skilled work and maybe a bit of training to do that work rather than just rely on menial tasks. So I've got no problem with business in prisons in that sense. If, as I say, people are paid decent wages to do decent skilled work.
And what about the principle, Phil, of this? I mean, is this something that you felt from what you found out through all your freedom of information requests that was actually, even though we were finding that certain contracts existed that we didn't know existed before, what are your thoughts on the actual principle of prison labour?
Well, I mean, I think I can address his point. I mean, I think, there needs to be, if we're talking about rehabilitation, looking at the incredibly low literacy levels in prisons, the absence often of experience in work, that there's a lot to be said for being able to provide new opportunities that are going to serve people once they're outside of the prison. I mean, my principal interest is about being able to look at the information and make it available so you can have this kind of debate. I mean, you mentioned about BMW, I have no information on that, but quite likely that it wasn't BMW doing that, it was actually a subcontractor of a subcontractor. I think it's quite analogous to the campaigns around producing of clothes in the developing countries, where you have such a long chain, if you like, and a lot of that work has been about tracking that so that people can take responsibility for how they've subcontracted that work out. The majority of companies which are have contracts aren't publicly well known, but they have been given a job by someone. I think if you are interested in this topic, if you think that it's right or wrong, the least you'll be able to have that information, be able to be transparent about the links and the long, and being able to analyse what is this contract, is this contract actually good for the prison service, and who's getting the best kind of deal out of it. After all, this is a publicly funded in terms of the prison services, our money, which is being involved as well, we're part of it as well. I think we have the rights to that kind of information, and then we can have that debate about whether you think that the principle, if you like, is one that's worth pursuing.
So, you've put a lot of time and effort into, particularly with these freedom of information requests, and going to the information tribunal as well. Do you think we've now got a pretty good picture of what's going on with prison labour in Britain?
I think we're getting it. I think that the access there certainly. The joke is that when we published the information, what we got paid for that. If you looked at the cost spent over the last 3 years, we earned less than the prisoners we were talking about. But I think that previously when we put in requests for information, it was taking 18 months to get a response, which generally was go away. Now we're getting the full details back within 20 days because the principle's been established. And so that if people want to have the information and think that it's available and they can have a look at it, and I think that's a good thing if they're interested. Having spoken to a number of people about this issue, a lot of people aren't that fast. I mean, I think, prisoners do tend to exist in a world which are away and secure and out of public sight and mind. If they're not bothering people outside, then that's a good thing. And I think that people don't necessarily see it as being an issue. They're just happy that they are locked away. And I think that's part of the issue, that we can't have a proper debate about it because people don't want to engage. They just don't, unsympathetic. They've committed a crime. Well, banged away. If they have to sew mailbags, shouldn't have committed the crime. That's the reaction we've got. So in terms of have we got more information, I think more information is available if you want to dig. Whether the appetite is there for people to be interested is another matter.
So you've had a bit of experience of this whole thing of doing freedom of information requests. Can you give us just in a nutshell how they work?
Yeah, well, anybody can make a request to a public body. There's a list on the website for the government website for which public body is available, but that pretty much covers every public body that has received public funds is eligible people to make a request for information. You just need to email the organisation and ask for that information. There are very few requirements in terms of what you have to say. You don't have to say why you need the information. You simply have to kind of specify in as much detail as possible, and the organisation has to help you be served with that information. It is, it's duty bound to, the presumption is that you'll provide the information. There are exemptions, and this is where we, the problem becomes, there are exemptions around commercial confidentiality, about personal records, things like that, and they balance the public interest of your right to know with these exemptions designed to protect the proper running of this organisation. But anybody can do it, and it's not the preserve of professional journalists, it's not the preserve of MPs or anything else. It's something that's available to everybody. If you've got an email account, email it in. You don't need to give your proper name, you just need to be able to kind of put the information in and ask, and then start the process.
And then, of course, if you're just told you're not having this information, you can then take it further?
Yes, you can ask for an internal review. In other words, asking the organisation to look at itself and see if it carried out the review, it carried out the request properly. And if not, you can go to the Information Commissioner and say, I don't think this was done properly. Can you rule on that? The Information Commissioner has done a lot of work in terms of speeding up the backlog. They had a horrific number of cases they were trying to deal with, which is they spent a lot of time clearing up. It can be a very long process. Can be very quick, you know. Quite often that information is publicly available anyway, and you'll be said, actually, if you look at such and such a place, you'll find it out anyway. But it's there. It's one of the few freedom information laws we've got. You know, it's come up 5th anniversary. It's mostly used by businesses, not by journalists, to find out about information about competitors, and probably something that perhaps people can take on themselves. And if they want to find information about Bristol City Council, about the local NHS, they want to find out information about academic institutions, all of them are subject to the FOI, and people should exercise their right to find that information.
Overall though, Phil, through all the stuff you found out, do you think prison labour is exploitation, or is the work experience a good thing?
I think it's impossible to say, because it varies from prison to prison. And I think that there was a case at Coldingley with the Bar Project, which is a very interesting, very successful project, which met an untimely end.
Can you just tell us about that project, Andrew, because I saw you nodding there. You obviously, you know about that one.
Yeah, we ran it. It was a Horror League. Are very interested in work in prison, what we call real work in prison, and attempting to make work in prison resemble as much as possible work in the community. Not for all prisoners, but particularly for those on long sentences who are going to be there for years, and at the moment just kick their heels on bunks for decades, potentially at a time. Long sentence prisoners, you know, what we did was, in Coldingley Prison, we set up a social enterprise, which was a graphic design studio called Barbed, as Phil says. We trained six to begin with, but it went on to slightly higher numbers as we had turnover. Six prisoners as graphic designers. If you went to the studio, it was quite a striking thing, because there they were with their Macs, and you wouldn't know that they were in a prison while they were there. And they did a lot of work for the prison service, for other charities, for various government agencies, designing reports and things like that. Now, it was run as a social enterprise, which means any profit that was made by the business, although it never got to that stage of making a profit, would have been ploughed back in to it. The radical thing about it, as beyond the actual quality of the work and the training that they were getting, was that they were actually paid around the minimum wage. And initially, at least, they were paying income tax and national insurance, as well as making voluntary contributions to, I think, about 30% of their salary went to a charitable fund to help families of prisoners. And they also contributed voluntarily to victim support. And that was to replicate the fact that they weren't paying for their bed and board. You couldn't legally ask a prisoner to pay for their bed and board, because the whole point is they've been put to prison because they committed a crime. Unfortunately, a number of things happened down the line which forced us to close the studio. The first thing was that, from our point of view, the really radical thing, other than paying them the minimum wage, was that they were paying tax and national insurance. And from our perspective, this was engaging guys who had been inside for years, not just with the world of work, but its responsibilities, you know, and engaging them, guys who perhaps had lived in a cash-in-hand culture before they went inside, actually finding a cash in hand culture in terms of the work that Phil's been talking about, where it's peanuts and it is cash in hand, kind of, you know, the economy that the law abiding citizen lives in, where you pay you get your wage, you pay your tax, you contribute, you know, engaging them with that. It was very radical. Unfortunately, the prison service dawned on them that probably meant that they would have workers' rights. And they didn't like that, so we eventually got a letter from the Inland Revenue handing back the tax.
Really?
Yeah. handing back the tax that the prisoners had paid. The other problem we had was that not because of overcrowding in Coldingley Prison, but overcrowding throughout the system, which creates a great churn of prisoners, so people are moved from one prison to another to make space for somewhere elsewhere. We would find that we would interview guys for jobs, and then maybe the next day they'd been shipped out of the prison. We found that we lost a lot of employees for that same reason, despite investing a lot of money in training them and developing them, only for them to then be shipped out. The time out of cell that prisoners were allowed across the estate was contracted because of the issue of overcrowding and staff resources. So in fact, the opening hours of the studio continued to shrink. There was less time that they were allowed to actually do the work. And in the end, we were trying to run it like a business, and we couldn't, which was... So sadly, we had to close it.
So you think, I mean, although this is clearly, I mean, for the prisoners involved, was actually genuinely preparing them for the world outside and giving them some, you know, much more self-respect than some of these, you know, literally peanuts wages type schemes. I mean, did you feel actually obstructed by the prison service?
At times. I mean, we were often helped as well by individuals. You know, if you've got a good governor, and we certainly had a good governor when we first went into Coldingley, then, you know, you can get a lot done. But more generally, I mean, certainly the Labour government showed no interest in the issue. Interestingly, we do have interest from the coalition, and indeed Ken Clark, who we spoke about at the beginning when I came on, did mention work in prison in his speech. It was in the coalition government's programme of government, and that's partly because we've been lobbying them for a long time on this issue. That we took various shadow Conservative spokesmen to Barb to see it in action, and they get, I'm not sure they're quite there on the idea of them paying tax or even being paid the minimum wage, but there's certainly accept the idea of paying prisoners more for what they do, and for as much as possible making it a direct relationship between the prisoner as employee and the company or whoever as employer. So I think that there's potential for some shift here.
Well, I'm quite shocked that these government people would say, well, we don't want prisoners paying tax, we can't have that.
No, I know. I mean, you would think that would be a good thing. I mean, what the government is now saying is that they would pay a money to victims fund, which I think is their way of replicating tax. I mean, I do think that asking the guys who do these kind of projects to donate to victims charities is a good thing to do. But I think the principle of getting them to pay tax, it just says so much more about you know, you can be a citizen. You know, you are not, as Phil said, someone just locked away that we're all going to forget about. Because that attitude publicly might be popular, and it might be very widespread. But if we actually want guys who go in prison to come out and not reoffend, then we do have to engage with them as individuals and as citizens.
Okay, just a final question. If the Howard League could change just one thing in the prison system, what would you do?
That's tricky. We would reduce the prison population by at least a third, and that would be a start. There's a huge shopping list that we could look at there.
Okay. Well, that's all for this week. Coming up next, the Sky News at 7 o'clock. And after that, Friday night is Music Night with BCFM's Mashup to the Weekend. And you'll be in the expert hands of Sam Walsh, that's DJ Spungold. And at 8 p.m, Johnny Royden's Sample Show. Do please join us at 5 on Friday Drive Time each week here on BCFM 93.2. If you have a story for us, questions about this evening's programme, or want to suggest a guest for a future show, go to thisweek.org.uk or email me at tony@bcfm.org.uk. Thanks very much to this guest in the first hour, Dr. Lee Salter from the University of the West of England, to Andrew Nielsen from the Howard League for Penal Reform, and Phil Chamberlain from prisonlabour.org.uk, and of course Marina Morris and old Labour economist Martin Summers. See you next week.
Bristol, and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.